Hi there, I'm Gavin Crawford. I'm a writer, an actor, and a comedian. And for the last 8 or 9 years, I have been navigating life with my mother's increasing dementia. Has it been sad? Yeah. Has it been funny? Also, yeah. That's what my brand new podcast series, Let's Not Be Kidding, is about. It's the true story of my life as a comedian, my mom, and dementia. Let's Not Be Kidding, with me, Gavin Crawford. A new 7-part series from CBC Podcasts, available now.
Before we start, a warning. Today's episode of The Big Story contains graphic content. Some crimes are so ugly that everyone they touch desperately hopes they will fade with time. But of course they don't, and so almost 10 years later, Woodstock, Ontario, known as the Friendly City, is reliving a very specific horror.
The search continues today for 9-year-old Tori Stafford, who vanished on her way home from school yesterday.
The grandparents of Tori Stafford are offering a $10,000 reward for the return of the 9-year-old girl who hasn't been seen or heard from since earlier this month.
Surveillance camera footage has been released showing what appears to be missing 9-year-old Tori Stafford and an unidentified woman. She's
described a 6-week police investigation into the abduction of 9-year-old Tori Stafford has led to the arrest of two suspects. 18-year-old Terry Lynn McClintock is
It started with whispers among family and friends. They'd been informed that the woman who confessed to her part in the kidnapping, rape, and murder of 9-year-old Tori Stafford had been transferred from a prison to what's called a healing lodge in Saskatchewan. The community at large heard of this, and the local newspaper got wind of it, and it quickly made its way up to the highest levels of government.
The minister has asked that the Commissioner of Correctional Services review such decisions to ensure they are done properly and in accordance with long-standing policy.
So why was Terry Lynn McClintock transferred to the Healing Lodge? How does that process work? Has she demonstrated any reasons she should serve out her sentence in more comfortable surroundings? And behind the understandable outrage and inevitable politics is a bigger question worth asking. If the point of our correctional system is to rehabilitate offenders, even the worst ones, should Terry Lynn McClintock not get the same treatment every inmate gets? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story.
You know, it's shocking for Canada, and it's appalling for some people, and some people think it's an okay idea for rehabilitation. But in Woodstock, it's not an exaggeration to say it's that community still hurts deeply from what happened.
Randy Richmond is a longtime reporter for the London Free Press. He's been on this file since Tori Stafford went missing in 2009, and he's now front and center covering the current developments.
Terry Lynn McClintock is the woman who was pleaded guilty to first-degree murder, the first-degree murder of Victoria, or Tori Stafford. Tori, as her family called her. Terry Lynn McClintock is the ex-girlfriend of Michael Rafferty, and on April 8, 2009, Terry Lynn McClintock lured Tori Stafford into Michael Rafferty's car. Tori Stafford was walking home from school in Woodstock, Ontario, and Terry Lynn McClintock approached her and said, have a puppy in the car, come on in and see it, and she got Tori to the car. They pulled her in, went to a remote farm area. Michael Rafferty tortured, raped, and killed Tori Stafford. Terry Lynn McClintock tried to take the blame for the actual killing at trial, but ultimately it was ruled that although she was there and guilty of first-degree murder, he did the actual killing.
And 10 years later, we're talking about Terry Lynn McClintock again.
Well, yeah, so Terry Lynn McClintock, you know, went to Grand Valley Institution in Kitchener, which is a prison for women, a federal prison for women, and has a range of security levels. And we heard about her again a couple years later. She was convicted of assaulting a fellow inmate, and it was a pretty brutal and savage attack. She lured this inmate into talking to her. They have a peer-to-peer sort of mentor program, and so she asked this inmate to come and talk to her in private so they could talk, and this inmate could help Terry Lynn McClintock. And she just used it as a way to get at this inmate and put a pretty savage beating on her. She pleaded guilty to that. And then we didn't hear much about her until when all of a sudden it came out, it surfaced that she'd been transferred from that institution to an Indigenous healing lodge and a Cree First Nation in Saskatchewan. And it was Tori's father, Rodney Stafford, who raised the alarm, and the London Free Press got a hold of that, got a hold of Rodney, and confirmed it with himself and another family member, and went with the story, and it just seemed to explode after that. Well, because of the nature of the crime, it was well covered. It was a horrible incident, and Terry Lynn McClintock, in her testimony at Rafferty's trial, was just, you could just see the violence in her nature and the horrible upbringing she had, and she became quite a figure in Canada for evil, I guess, and violence.
What is a healing lodge?
Well, you know, I've never been inside a healing lodge, but, you know, you use Indigenous principles to come to terms with what you've done, to come to terms with your past, to take a more spiritual and cultural journey so that you are, you know, approach rehabilitation. For Indigenous people, it's quite a different way of dealing with their background and their past and their crimes than traditional jails. And traditional jails and prisons are disproportionately filled with Indigenous people. And this is a different way of approaching your rehabilitation. It's strongly supported in the Indigenous community, and I've been in court where people have been recommended for it, Indigenous people. This case is different for me, for sure, because Terry Lynn McClintock at no point said she was Indigenous, and we went through her final statements, and there's no indication that she is, and it turns out, whether she is or not, that you don't have to be. And this is news to me. I didn't realize that you could get into an Indigenous healing lodge or Indigenous healing program by sort of asking for it and acknowledging and agreeing to abide and follow their teachings.
So how does the transfer actually work? This would be something that she would apply to correctional services and then go through a process. Do we have any idea how it happened?
We don't have a clear idea how it happened, and that's something I do want to find out more of, the actual process in general. Correctional Service Canada is not too forthcoming in how they explain how things are done, partly because they worry about their prisoners' privacy rights. It came out in discussions or debate in either, I believe, Parliament or on Parliament Hill, that she had been already in a sort of a healing lodge program or an Indigenous program in Grand Valley Institution. So there is some sort of cottage there that has a place for a woman who can start this programming. So I do know from, you know, looking at parole board hearings and documents in the past, it's basically similar to what you think. You know, you take courses, you're on good behavior, you go see the psychologist or psychiatrist, and you impress them with your ability, with your rehabilitation, and you know, you apply for different privileges. You apply for, you know, day passes at some point. You apply for this, that, and the other thing. And so she must have applied for it. I'm not sure, but, you know, applied to go out here. But that's, you know, what happens. I mean, they are supposed to rehabilitate you, the prison system. And so off she went.
What happened when word got out that she was there politically?
Right. Well, what's interesting, just to go back a bit, is that the family members of victims are notified when things are changing with, you know, with the killers. And so it was back late last year, December, that some family members heard about this, and they were quite angry, but they thought, well, there's nothing we can do. I mean, this is Correctional Service Canada. They have the right to move people around. It's not like a parole hearing where you get a chance to say why the person should be not let out. In fact, if there's day passes applied for, the family has a chance sometimes to oppose. So this is sort of an internal thing, they thought, and so they just let it go. Through different reasons, the communication somehow didn't get to Rodney Stafford, Tory's father. He found out. He didn't come out and say much, but some of his friends on Facebook were talking about it, and that's how we picked up on it. To be honest, we ran the story, and I was not expecting this reaction, and my editors were not expecting this reaction. We knew there'd be anger. We were surprised that it went so far politically.
Where has it gone politically? What happened immediately when you published the story?
Well, right after we published the story, of course, we had the immediate reaction from people in our area, southwestern Ontario and Woodstock. The same day that the newspaper story came out and the day after it came online, it ended up exploding in the Ontario legislature. And it was a progressive conservative MPP asked his own party, MPP David Piccini from the Piro area, raised the story in the legislature, asking his party leaders for a response. So the two cabinet ministers got up and expressed their outrage and vowed to push the federal government for answers. One of them was Community Safety Minister Michael Tobolo, and you know, he was quite upset about it. And the other person, of course, was the longtime MPP for Woodstock, Ernie Hardiman. And just as an aside, it's, you know, it's shocking for Canada and it's appalling for some people. And some people think it's an okay idea for rehabilitation. But in Woodstock, it's not an exaggeration to say it's that community still hurts deeply from what happened. So Ernie Hardiman, of course, is reflecting his own constituents' outrage. So, it came up in the Ontario legislature. And I thought, well, that's that. You know, that's politicians being politicians. And then the next day, I think it was the next day, it came up in the House of Commons. And this was surprised me. Perhaps it shouldn't. Maybe it's a bit of my political nativity. But it came up in the House of Commons. And the Conservatives, of course, slammed the ruling Liberals for the transfer. It's surprised me because, you know, that it reached this level. And it surprised me that Liberal Public Safety Minister Ralph Goodall announced that there'd be a review of the transfer decision, which I frankly didn't know you could do. And it's shocking to me that they were talking about a specific inmate in the House of Commons. And so it just sort of blew up again. And it's been continuing. It's a good wedge issue between Liberals and Conservatives.
Right.
Let's face it. And so, you know, you could be cynical and say that the Progressive Conservatives provincially and the Conservatives federally are jumping on something they see as something to score political points. But I have to believe as well that there's lots of inherent outrage, and they're certainly reflecting probably the majority of people in Canada's opinion about this. So, you know, it's just one of those things that just hit the headlines quickly. And it's still continuing. The Cree First Nation, the chief out there, he spoke to the media, issued a release saying that, you know, why is this happening? We used to be consulted on who was let in here, and now we're not.
Huh.
And he was upset. He gave Correctional Service Canada the benefit of the doubt. He told me on the phone, he said, you know, I believe that they do due diligence, but I'm a dad and I'm a grandfather, and this just troubles me that this woman who killed a child is out here. And then it's continued because people are starting to look at what these healing lodges are like. They're starting to look at, you know, why does Correctional Service Canada have this sort of ultimate power without review? So it's lingering there. The family and friends, some family and friends are planning a protest on Parliament Hill November the 2nd. There's the usual petitions going around. I think there's even T-shirts being sold. I haven't looked into that yet. It's interesting. It's just exploded. And I've, as someone who's on the ground from the start and who had to suffer, and I'll say suffer in a loose term because I didn't suffer like other people did, but anybody who watched Terry Lynn McClintock in court suffered because she was a very, very damaged person, but very quiet and in court. But other evidence showed how brutal she could be, obviously, besides what she did here. And so it was a very, very bizarre situation watching her.
You were there when it happened. You were covering the story when the murder unfolded. For a lot of people, that was a long time ago, almost 10 years ago. They're not quite, they might not be familiar with the story, or the rest of Canada might not be familiar with the story. What was it like covering that story in Woodstock? What did it do to that community?
Oh, the kidnapping and the search and the bad blood that it created within the family, it really shattered Woodstock. You know, it doesn't define Woodstock. I've never suggested the city is defined by a tragedy, but it certainly shattered and haunts them still. There was something about it, her innocence, Tori's innocence, the fact that it took so long to find her killers. Her mother and father were divorced, and it was an acrimonious separation. And every day her mother, Terry McDonald, stood out on the doorstep of her house and sought the public help. She was considered by police the number one suspect for a long time, actually right up until Terry Lynn McClintock confessed in May of 2009. Police considered her the number one suspect. They thought it was anything from a fake ransom to a drug deal gone bad. It was awful. The attention that she got was awful. It led to, you know, on-camera fights with her ex-husband, Rodney Stafford. It was just a huge drama, and it split the community over people who thought that the family was involved, people who thought they didn't. It was just bizarre. It just went on and on, and then it just ended so dramatically with the confession and the arrest, and then it took another 2 months to find Tori's body. And it's the place itself is just a haunting place where her remains are found.
How do you wrestle with the idea, and yourself as somebody who's covered the courts a lot, you know, the idea that our prison system is there for rehabilitation, and maybe this is an effort at rehabilitation, and reconcile that with, you know, what you saw in court, what you heard in court, and what the families told you about what how they've suffered?
Well, that is tough. That is a tough issue to deal with, reconciling those two sentiments. I do a lot of coverage at the provincial jail in London, Ontario, where there's no rehabilitation, really, and it's led to all kinds of problems. And, you know, I believe in the idea of rehabilitation. I think that people can be rehabilitated. I've talked to enough criminals and people addicted to drugs and all kinds of people who've come back from bad places and made lives for themselves. Terry Lynn McClintock is a person who kind of haunts me a little bit because her life was horrible. And it's almost a mathematical equation. You can say anybody that went through what she went through is going to become damaged. Were they going to kill someone? Not necessarily. It can't be an excuse, but certainly when you have a life that she did, which was full of abuse and horrible situations, she turned out to be terrible. Can she be rehabilitated? I don't know. I'm not a psychologist. I really wrestle with this question because, again, in court, she was so calm and her voice was very quiet and kind of almost whiny. But meanwhile, we saw letters that she wrote to friends that talked about horrible things and rap lyrics that she liked to quote from that were all about, you know, murder and death. And she talked about how much she wanted to kill people, and she did horrible things when she was a child, and she did horrible things with Tori Stafford. So, yeah, I don't have an answer for that. I don't know how to reconcile it. I guess I'm leaving my options, my final options open.
Yeah.
I mean, Carla Homolka is out with children, right? In a family somewhere.
Yeah. That's what I was going to ask you. It seems like such an obvious comparison, and I know how that split Canada.
Right. So Carla Homolka, though, is, you know, because of the deal with the devil and all the rest of that, is out. And as far as we know, you know, the last we heard from other reporters was that she's out and has a family. And so surely if a person involved in the murders of three girls, including her own sister, can be rehabilitated, does that mean everybody can? I don't know. You know, that's a big question. I don't know. And so, I am torn. We all have our doubts. I mean, who knows, right?
There's no way to find out until, you know, the system says she's rehabilitated.
Isn't that the truth? There's no way to find out until she is released someday and has a life that doesn't involve crime, or is released someday and does something horrible. And then that is the horrible part. We won't know until she's free, really, for sure.
Yeah. Thanks a ton.
Thank you.
Randy Richmond, reporter for the London Free Press. That was The Big Story. For more from us, please take a visit to thebigstorypodcast.ca. Check out some of our other episodes and tell us what we should be covering. Hit us up on social media too, at Big Story Podcast, on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram. We want to hear from you. And of course, subscribe. Everywhere you get podcasts, rate us, review us, tell your friends. I'm Jordan Heath-Rawlings. Thanks for listening. We'll talk tomorrow.